Craving the coffee flavor you love, but without the caffeine? Kachava's got you covered with their newest coffee flavor. This all-in-one nutrition shake delivers bold, authentic flavor crafted from premium decaffeinated Brazilian beans. Quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Kachava's all-in-one nutrition shake and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Whether you're craving that coffee taste to kickstart your morning ritual or as a nutrient-packed reward to round out your afternoon, Kachava keeps you fueled and satisfied wherever your day takes you. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. And for the times you feel like switching it up, you've got 7 flavors to choose from, all with the highest quality ingredients. Treat yourself to the flavor and nutrition your body craves. Go to kachava.com and use code SHAKE. New customers get 15% off their first order. That's kachava.com, code SHAKE.
That's kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul and the night.
Hello, American Prestige listeners. It's Derek here with the weekly news roundup. Danny is sick, quite ill, actually, apparently, this week. So we're sending our best wishes to him for a speedy recovery. And so we're doing something a little bit different this week. The second half of this episode, I'm going to be interviewing Negar Mortazavi about the protests in Iran. So stay tuned for that. We won't be covering them in the roundup portion of this. But to help me get through the rest of the news this week, I've dipped into the celebrity guest pool, as they do on the Tonight Show or the like. And I'm very grateful and very pleased to welcome Matt Leck to the program. Matt is from Left Reckoning, The Majority Report, The Jacobin Show. He's all over the place. Matt, thank you. This was on very short notice, I know, so I want to thank you for doing it.
Oh, no, I'm happy to do it. It's an honor to be here, and I wish Danny Bessner best of a quick recovery.
There you go. We're not even going to make any jokes about this because he is apparently very sick, so get better, Danny. All right, Matt, you want to start us off? Take us through what's going on this week.
Yeah, so well, let's start with Venezuela. Trump is meeting with oil executives and preparing a long-term takeover of the Venezuelan oil industry.
Yeah, it's going to be fun stuff for everybody. Trump met with a bunch of oil executives on Friday to urge them all to dive back into the Venezuelan market to the tune of at least $100 billion in investment, which is what they think they're going to need to get Venezuelan oil production back up to the levels that Trump wants it to be at. Trump has got stars in his eyes about this. He's convinced that taking over and juicing Venezuelan oil production is going to be the key to getting oil prices down to $50 per barrel, which is where he wants them to be for political reasons. There are a lot of potential complications with that, number one being that $50 barrel oil would probably destroy the U.S. shale industry. But leaving those things aside, he is pitching hard for these oil companies to go back into Venezuela. He had, I think, mixed success. There doesn't seem to have been any immediate outpouring from the execs that they were convinced by his spiel or that they were ready to get back into Venezuela immediately. There's a lot of concerns about, of course, security, about the possibility that this house of cards that Trump has built since ousting Nicolas Maduro, kidnapping him in the dead of night, really, out of Caracas, could all fall apart. There are concerns generally about Venezuelan oil, which needs a lot of refinement to get to market, to be useful at a time when oil is already at 60-ish dollars per barrel in the 60s, which is not just well down from where it was just a couple of years ago. So there's an economic viability question. I think the CEO of ExxonMobil was sounded particularly sort of pessimistic about the idea of going back into Venezuela or going into Venezuela after the meeting, at which point Trump said, well, he probably won't invite ExxonMobil to be part of the project anyway. So a little petulant exchange there. So that's exciting. As you said, there's a plan, I guess, that they're hatching to just indefinitely take over the Venezuelan oil industry. The Wall Street Journal reported on this earlier this week on Wednesday, I believe, that they're basically just going to take over PDVSA, the Venezuelan state-run oil company. And the idea would be that the U.S. would take over selling Venezuelan oil. Like the state oil company would pump it, ship it to the U.S. The U.S. would then be responsible for selling it. That's somehow gonna achieve all these goals of bringing oil down to $50 a barrel. It's gonna keep Russia and China out of Venezuela, which is another one of Trump's goals. And Venezuela will basically be a colony, I guess, or an oil colony. I don't know what you want to call it. But this doesn't seem like it's gonna end anytime soon. The White House is downplaying the idea of elections. So I don't think this state of affairs is going anywhere. It's just going to be Venezuela as a subsidiary of the Trump administration. There were some questions this week about the initial sale of oil. I think, you know, Venezuela has sent or is sending upwards of 50 million barrels of oil as an initial kind of levy to the United States that the U.S. is going to sell. There's some question about where that money's going to go. I know there was a report that Trump is going to putting a big chunk of that revenue in a bank in Qatar, presumably to get around any lawsuits that might be filed to get a piece of Venezuelan oil revenue from anybody who has grievances or had grievances with the Maduro government. So we're already doing schemes and you know, bank fraud, I guess, or bank schemes to get around the courts. So this is already off to a weird start, and the potential for corruption here, given the people who are in charge of it, is sky high. So everything looks like it's gonna go well.
Yeah, well, I mean, good that we've addressed the giant pile of money and the different sort of corporate vultures swarming it. What does this mean for our actual diplomatic relations with Venezuela and maybe Venezuela's with the rest of the world?
Yeah, so one of the demands that the U.S. had of Delcy Rodriguez before allowing her to just kind of stay around and keep the Maduro government mostly in place was that Venezuela cut ties with anybody on the U.S. naughty list. So that would include China, Russia, Iran, you know, pretty much, you know, the enemies list. Diplomatically, in terms of the U.S.-Venezuela relationship, there has been talk of reestablishing relations. The Trump 1 administration cut off relations in 2019, but the U.S. State Department did send a team last week to Venezuela to assess the possibility of reopening the embassy. So that looks like it could happen at some point, assuming that all continues to go well in this new ownership relationship that we have with the Venezuelan administration.
On Thursday evening, Maria Corina Machado met with Trump and apparently presented the Nobel Prize to him. What's your...
Oh, man. Oh, this is so good. Yeah, she met with him. This has been in the cards for several days now. There was a question about whether or not she would try to present him with the Nobel. The Nobel Committee has already said, like, you can't transfer the award like this. It's not official. But she nevertheless apparently went to the White House and presented him with the medal. She didn't tell reporters afterwards. She didn't say whether he had accepted it or not. I have to believe that he did, but we'll see. I guess we'll find out. I don't think that bought her any consideration. I mean, she was obviously there to pitch herself as the proper viceroy, U.S. viceroy for Venezuela. But Trump is already behind Delcy Rodriguez and company. And even the White House, even on Thursday, as this meeting was going on, or I think maybe shortly after, said it's had no problem with Rodriguez. She's been fine. So there's no indication that he's been swayed in any way, even by the presentation of the Nobel Medal, to rethink his means of administering Venezuela. At least nothing immediate, to say about that.
Well, I wonder if the Nobel Peace Prize people are reflecting on this episode at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows? Really, one of the more pathetic things that somebody has done to curry favor with Donald Trump, to grovel, yep, with your medal and just be like, here, take this. Okay, whatever, man.
And it's a Nobel Peace Prize, too. It's not just some small...
No, it's not like, you know, not out of a Cracker Jack box. It is a Nobel Peace Prize. Yeah.
Let's switch hemispheres here. In Yemen, so the Southern Transitional Council leader has fled and the group has fragmented.
Yes, after, you know, a couple of weeks where the Southern Transitional Council had tried to seize control of southern Yemen, only to be eventually beaten back by the Saudi government and the Saudi-led National Shield Coalition supporting the nominally internationally recognized government of Yemen. The Saudis were supposed to hold a meeting last week. I think we might have talked about this in the news last week. I can't remember. They were supposed to hold a meeting in Riyadh last week for the Southern Transitional Council and its leadership to discuss a new status quo for southern Yemen. Many of the STC leaders who were invited to that meeting attended, but the head of the STC, Idaras Azubaydi, did not, and apparently skipped town with the assistance of the United Arab Emirates, which has been backing the STC all this time. He skipped out of southern Yemen, made his way over to the Somaliland region, which is now recognized as an independent country by Israel, but nobody else still recognizes part of Somalia. From there, was flown to Mogadishu and then flown on to the UAE. So amid all of this, as he's, you know, taking flight and disappearing, basically, he hasn't made any public statements since then, as far as I know. The Secretary General of the Council on Friday, while he was still in Riyadh, and there's some question about whether the STC folks who did go to Riyadh were being basically held in custody by the Saudis. Nevertheless, he went on Yemeni television on Friday to announce that the group is dissolving. This was immediately rejected by a spokesperson for the STC who is not in Saudi custody, who's in the UAE with Zubaydi, presumably, who issued a statement saying this statement from the Secretary General was null and void. The STC is not disbanding. Apparently, what seems to be happening at this point is you've got some fragmentation happening here, and we'll see if they can patch it up. I think the chances are that the statement that they're disbanding was made in some duress. So whether you can take that seriously or not, I think remains to be seen. Nevertheless, things are now in a great deal of flux. You've got this faction of the STC that wants to disband, that's under the thumb of the Saudi monarchy at this point. You've also got Zubaydi and the other faction of leadership in the STC that's still being supported by the UAE, still lingering out there somewhere, although it's been driven out of Yemen apparently altogether. So I don't know how much of a factor the group's going to be moving forward. I will say that I don't think that the cause of southern Yemeni secession or independence is going anywhere, but it remains to be seen what form it's going to take with these latest developments.
And speaking of the UAE, the Somali government cuts ties with the UAE.
Yeah, this is a related story. So the Somali government and the UAE have been somewhat at odds for a while now, as the UAE is heavily invested in the Somaliland region. It's been investing in the region's ports and infrastructure and supporting the separatist government without recognizing it as an independent state, without going that far. After the Israelis recognized Somaliland as independent a couple of weeks ago, the UAE kind of surreptitiously started accepting passports issued by the Somaliland government, which is a sort of tacit acceptance of its independence. It also stopped, I think, processing visas for anybody with a Somali passport, which is another step in that direction. So tensions between these two countries were already not great, but the evacuation of Zubaydi, is why it's related to the Yemen story, the evacuation of Zubaydi through Somalia, he went from Somaliland to Mogadishu and then was flown from Mogadishu to the UAE, apparently without any notification from any Emirati official to the Somali government. This is apparently the last straw. That's how Somali officials have put it. They announced the cancellation earlier this week of all agreements with the UAE. That includes defense agreements, security agreements, port management contracts, pretty much any deal that the Somalis have made with the Emirati government. The UAE rejected the Somali government's right to cancel these deals. But more importantly, two other regions of Somalia, in addition to Somaliland, which obviously doesn't pay attention to anything the Somali government, federal government does. But two other regions of Somalia, Puntland and Jubaland, both of which are semi-autonomous, not outright secessionist, but semi-autonomous, they rejected the federal government's decision to cancel these contracts as well, putting further strain, I guess you could say, on the territorial integrity of Somalia, which is already under a great deal of strain, given what's going on in Somaliland.
Now let's move up to Gaza. The second phase of ceasefire begins with Israel still throttling humanitarian aid. Now, I'll just say I wasn't much impressed by the first phase of the ceasefire. What does this mean?
Well, the first phase never was fully implemented. It's still not fully implemented. There's still one body of a Gaza captive that hasn't been repatriated to Israel. The Israelis never made good on reopening the Rafah checkpoint. They're still holding out on that. And they never made good on, fully made good on their obligation to let humanitarian aid into the territory. They have done better, apparently, on the food situation. On the food side of things, the United Nations did say last week that aid organizations can now meet 100% of the minimum caloric standard for the first time since the October 7, 2023 attacks that kicked off the Gaza genocide. So that has improved. But what the Israelis have continued to do is throttle any import of durable shelter materials, which has left displaced Palestinians, with almost the entire population of Gaza is displaced at this point, sheltering either in the ruins of damaged or destroyed buildings or in tents that are not adequate for wintertime, that get flooded very easily, that come apart in heavy winds, are not equipped to block out heavy rains. So this has led to a number of people dying of exposure, a number of people dying in these damaged buildings that they're sheltering in when the rain gets so heavy that it collapses parts of those structures. So that continues to be a problem. So yes, phase one never fully implemented. But even so, on Wednesday, the Trump administration, via Steve Witkoff, their envoy, announced that phase two has begun. There was another big announcement. The Egyptian government said that it had negotiating with various Palestinian factions, Hamas, Palestinian Authority, Islamic Jihad, and they had agreed on the formation of a 15-member committee of Palestinian so-called technocrats, which is part of phase two. Those technocrats will manage the day-to-day administration of Gaza under the big board of peace that Donald Trump is going to chair. That will be the international executive for Gaza in a very League of Nations mandate sense. That board still hasn't been announced. I would have thought by now they would have announced the members of that board. They haven't done that yet, and that's a little bit peculiar to me, but we'll see. Maybe it'll just be another day or two. Nevertheless, there's supposed to be, in addition to the Board of Peace, we're supposed to be seeing the International Stabilization Force taking shape. There's still no indication of which countries are going to participate in that, if any have agreed to. The Israeli military is supposed to withdraw from further territory in Gaza. Meanwhile, the IDF, the Israeli military, is actually moving the yellow line deeper into Gaza and claiming more territory, by all accounts, on the ground. Hamas is supposed to disarm. This is the big question looming over this second phase. Hamas, very reluctant to disarm. They have argued that it would amount to surrendering the Palestinian resistance. They have offered to give up heavy weaponry and retain small arms. The Israeli government has flatly rejected that. So yeah, lots of questions about this second round and whether it's actually going to come off.
And we also have this story of the hunger strikers out of the UK.
Yes, we wanted to cover this. The Palestine Action Group, which has been outlawed by the UK government for its protests in support of Gaza and against the genocide. Four, I believe, members of that organization are people who were arrested for supporting that organization. Have been in a hunger strike, and a few of them ended their hunger strike this week. We asked the Prisoners for Palestine organization, which has kind of taken up their cause, to send us a statement that we could sort of read to kind of give people a sense of what's going on and a little call to action. And Matt, I'm gonna turn that over to you while I take a drink of water. But this is the statement that we received from them.
Yeah, here's a statement. Since November 2nd, the anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, eight prisoners affiliated with the now proscribed protest group Palestine Action have been conducting a rolling hunger strike in British prisons. The strikers have all been imprisoned pre-trial for their alleged involvement in direct actions that took place before the UK Labour government designated Palestine Action as a, quote, terrorist organization. The strike has been the largest in British prisons since the Irish Republican strikes of the early 1980s, when the Thatcher government allowed 10 people to die of starvation rather than meet their needs. Drawing on the legacy of the Irish strikers, as well as Palestinian prisoners and Guantanamo Bay detainees who have frequently used hunger strikes as a tactic of struggle behind prison walls, the prisoners for Palestine put forward five demands on the British state. One, end all censorship. Two, immediate bail. Three, right to a fair trial. Four, deproscribe Palestine Action. Five, shut down Elbit Systems. Yesterday, January 14th, three of the four remaining prisoners who had been on strike ended their hunger strikes following news that Elbit Systems UK was denied a £2 billion contract with the British Ministry of Defense. Two of them, Heba Mirassi and Kamran Ahmed, had gone 73 and 66 days without food, respectively, and were considered to be at high risk of death. In a statement announcing the end of their strike, the campaign celebrated the cancellation of the Elbit deal as a, quote, resounding victory for the hunger strikers, especially in light of the government's refusal to grant bail or meet with the strikers to this point. There is one prisoner who is currently still on strike, Umar Khalid, who went on a 12-day hunger strike in December, restarting his strike 5 days ago, and is still refusing food. The campaign is urging its supporters to turn their attention to Umar and to continue pushing for the remaining demands. They have released a toolkit specifically for supporters in the U.S., which is accessible through their Instagram page and website, prisonersforpalestine.org.
Thank you, Matt. So that's a statement from those guys, and do check out that link contribute what you can to the cause. It's a very worthy one.
Yeah, absolutely. Some more news here. The Sudanese military government is moving back into Khartoum, preparing a major military operation.
This was announced by the Prime Minister of the Sudanese military government, Kamil Idris, on Sunday. Kind of a symbolic milestone, I guess, although there is some connection between moving the capital and preparing for this, what could be the next phase of the conflict against the Rapid Support Forces. But he did announce that the government will return to Khartoum shortly after the war between the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces group began in April 2023. The military moved its de facto capital, and the military is still more or less the internationally recognized authority here, moved its capital effectively to Port Sudan, which is, you know, way up in the northeast on the Red Sea, because the RSF controlled most of Khartoum in the capital region. But early last year, there was a major offensive by the military that drove the RSF out of Khartoum. Hundreds of thousands of people have returned to the city as a result of that offensive, and the Sudanese military has been kind of slowly expanding its presence in the capital. This announcement is sort of partly meant to establish some legitimacy. The RSF has since fielded its own rival Sudanese government. So this is sort of a statement about who's the legitimate claimant to authority. Well, we're in the legitimate capital, so that must be us. But also there is this move apparently on the part of the Sudanese armed forces to gear up a new operation to take or retake, depending on your perspective, I guess, in this conflict, the Kordofan and Darfur regions. The RSF controls nearly all of Darfur and much of the Kordofan region. This has led to a lot of speculation, as we've talked about on this program, about the possibility of partitioning the country or, you know, what kind of de facto state of partition could exist. The Sudanese armed forces trying to put a pin in that, I think. They've had some recent operations in North Kordofan state against the RSF, and successful operations driven the RSF out of a couple of places. So that seems like the preliminary act to this major offensive that the SAF says it is aiming to undertake. moving the capital back to Khartoum puts, you know, the authorities much closer to where the fighting is and is likely to be moving forward. So I do think there's some strategic consideration there as well.
And moving over to China, China has a record trade surplus, is it's recording, despite U.S. tariffs. How is that part of Trump's plan, Derek?
Yeah, it's not really part of the plan. China recorded a $1.2 trillion surplus last year. This is according to data from its General Administration of Customs. That is a record, at least according to official Chinese government figures. And does kind of suggest that the tariffs aren't working, that despite the complications that they've posed for China's trade with the U.S., Beijing has found other customers around the world. Chinese firms have been able to diversify their customer base. They've also shifted some of their manufacturing capacity to countries outside China that have lower tariffs with the U.S. and can ship goods more cheaply, which only further embeds those Chinese firms in countries around the region and other parts of the world, and makes them more important as job providers, as employers. So it just expands really China's global reach. I'm guessing this is not what the Trump administration was hoping to achieve with the tariffs, but that does seem to be how it's worked out. This is not, though, I would say, entirely good news for the Chinese government, which has been for some time now trying to rebalance the Chinese economy away from reliance on exports to boost domestic demand and domestic consumption. Structurally, that's hard to do when you're making $1.2 trillion a year in foreign trade surplus. There's a definite incentive to lean into that. So that may complicate the bigger economic project that Beijing is trying to undertake.
I don't quite see how that's going to be good for us either way.
No, I really, but it's beside the point for the U.S. It's not good either way. You're right. But yeah, just a little caveat, I guess.
Yeah, trust the process, I guess, here for us Americans. Japan has snap elections looming. What's the situation there?
So the Japanese government has been on unstable footing for quite a while now. The Liberal Democratic Party has been losing support, bleeding support, mostly to its right. That led to a couple of election losses in both the House of Representatives and the House of Councilors in recent elections. And the LDP lost its regular coalition partner, Komeito, and had to make a new coalition with a right-wing party called Isshin. That currently those two parties collectively have just a one seat majority in the House of Representatives, not terribly flexible or functional. So Takaichi Sanai, who took over as LDP leader and prime minister late last year in the wake of these election defeats as the party sought new leadership, it turns out she's been quite popular so far. She's got an approval rating approaching 70%. She's decided that with her approval rating that high, this may be a good time to try to expand on that one seat majority. So the reporting out of Tokyo is that when the House of Representatives reconvenes on January 23rd, she will dissolve the body, call a snap election maybe as soon as early February, and try to kind of capitalize on her popularity to see if she can improve the party's position in the House of Representatives. There is some chance. I mean, I'm not expert in Japanese politics. Don't quote me on this, but I feel like there is some chance that this could backfire if Japanese voters feel like they're being manipulated into, you know, kind of playing along with this political project, that could eat into Takaichi's popularity, but probably not. I'm just throwing that out there as a possibility, but I think this is probably the right move for her. I'm just suggesting there is a possibility of a downside here.
In Ukraine, 2025 was the most dangerous year since 2022 for civilians.
Yeah, this was data released earlier this week by the United Nations, its monitoring mission in Ukraine, that tracked 2,514 civilian deaths and over 12,000 civilian injuries due to what it said was conflict-related violence in 2025, which, as you said, made it the most dangerous year for Ukrainian civilians since the first year of the latest Russian invasion in 2022. According to the UN, the vast majority of those casualties occurred, unsurprisingly, in parts of the country that are still under Ukrainian government control due to Russian attacks. Most of them occurred in the areas around the front line, which are mostly evacuated, but typically there are some people who either cannot or don't want to evacuate when they're given evacuation orders and when the fighting moves in. And they also, I guess, unsurprisingly, seem to be bearing the brunt of the risk here.
Yeah, the images of the sort of drone fiber optics and some of the stuff coming out of there is really, it's horrific in its own kind of way.
I think it's like what the future portends. It's also a little bit misleading, I feel like, because a lot of the stories that you get out of Ukraine about the major Russian attacks and the you know death tolls talk about these high-tech bombardments with drones and Russia, it's advanced missiles. They just fired their hypersonic whatever Oreshnik missile. It's not actually hypersonic missile, but it is somewhat advanced. And like, that's the stuff that grabs the attention, is when they, go through these nightly heavy bombardments away from the front line. And you get, a few people killed here, a few people killed there. And that's devastating enough. But what I don't think you get reported in Western media, especially, is the day-to-day grind on the front line and the shelling, the low-tech stuff, like the artillery, the tanks, that type of thing, where really it still seems like most of the casualties are coming from.
Greenland had meetings with our government, and apparently it doesn't seem like the whatever situation is going on has been resolved.
Donald Trump wants what he wants, and he wants Greenland, apparently. The foreign minister of Denmark, Lars Løkke Rasmussen, and the foreign minister of Greenland, Vivian Motzfeldt, went to Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, where they met with Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance, because I guess they haven't suffered enough, to see if they could come to some kind of arrangement that would assuage whatever it is that's driving Donald Trump to lust for Greenland. His comments mostly have focused on national security lately, but we've seen him go through the, like, we have to have the minerals thing and, various other, there's this bizarre push by his tech oligarch pals to build, frontier cities in Greenland, like just really strange stuff. So there's a whole host of things going on here, but mainly the focus has been on security questions about, military presence in the Arctic and, what does the United States want or need here? Or what are the concerns about Greenland? And so they tried to come to some accord and apparently failed. After the meeting, Rasmussen told reporters that it's clear. He said, it's clear that the president has this wish of conquering over Greenland. So I would take that as a, we didn't get anything done. They agreed to establish a working group to continue to address concerns about control over Greenland and security in the Arctic region, which is tantamount to saying they accomplished nothing. Donald Trump is still lusting for Greenland. No change there, despite the high-level visit.
They should have went to one of those trophy makers and got him a little...
Could have given, like, the Greenland Award for International Peace or something. Yeah, like the... just something, yeah.
Exactly. I think that's all you need to do. U.S. halts immigrant visa processing. What does this mean? And also, what does this mean for the Trump gold card?
I don't think anybody who's going to be affected by this halt would have qualified for the gold card anyway. It announced on Wednesday that it is halting immigrant visa processing, the administration did, for a whopping 75 countries I don't know if anybody's published. I have not seen the full list of countries, but the general tenor of this seems to be these are developing nations with predominantly non-white populations. This comes as no surprise given this administration's predilections, but that's the basic thrust of it. And I don't know what more to say about this except that people should just stop coming to the United States. Like the World Cup should cancel. The Olympics, how the hell are they going to hold the Olympics here? Like, I just don't understand any of this anymore. They've made it so unpalatable to even try to come to the U.S. I just don't, I don't get it anymore. Just don't come. Don't come here. It's not worth it.
Yeah. And final note here, New York Times reports on possible U.S. war crime.
Yes. The New York Times reported earlier this week that the very first strike that the U.S. military undertook in its war on speedboats that we've all been following since early September, the first strike involved a military aircraft that had been disguised to look like a civilian aircraft. Now, there are some considerations here in terms of why it was disguised and whether that played into the strike. There are indications that the plane was flying low enough to be seen by the people on the boat that was attacked. And that they may have recognized it as a civilian aircraft, in which case there's a term for this in international law. It's called perfidy. It is a war crime. It's a black and white war crime. You cannot disguise military vehicles or military vessels as civilian vessels in order to gain an advantage over your adversary. And under the Trump administration's own terms by which it is waging the war on speedboats, which is that the U.S. is in an armed conflict with drug traffickers, that makes this a war crime pretty unambiguously. Like I said, there may be some kind of on the margins wiggle room here, but the way the New York Times described it seems pretty clear that it was a war crime. And I know it's sort of quaint at this point in the Trump 2 era, I guess, just in general, to talk about international law and war crimes. But I do think it's important to keep mentioning them. And this does definitely seem to have been one.
Yeah, it feels like we're getting a sort of graduate course in advanced war crimes, like
yes.
Don't shoot people who are shipwrecked.
Right.
Right. You know, don't. Yeah. Perfidy. It's a great word. Well, what are we?
So, yeah, that's it. Matt, I want to thank you again so much for doing this. Really appreciate it. Tell people where they can find you these days.
Yeah, Left Reckoning and Majority Report, but also go over to on YouTube, the Jacobin Meg YouTube channel, where David Griscom and I are doing the Jacobin Show, which comes out Friday mornings at 10 a.m.
That's awesome, guys. Check out all of those shows. And like I said, stay tuned because coming up, you're going to have my interview with Negar Mortazavi to talk about the situation in Iran. And that's all this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And I guess to borrow Danny's sign off, keep on rocking in the free world. Hello, everybody. I am here with Negar Mortazavi. She is an award-winning journalist and commentator, editor and host of the Iran podcast, and a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. She's also a returning guest. So thank you, Negar, for coming back to the show. And I know we set this up on short notice, so I really do appreciate you being generous with your time.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be back.
So I just want to walk through what's been going on over the last, I think it's 2.5 weeks at this point. And let's start with where things stand now. I've seen it's been very difficult to get a bead on the status of the protests, any information under this communications blackout that the Iranian government imposed several days ago. So only just in the last day or so, I'm starting to see reporting that suggests the protests themselves have maybe subsided somewhat, or that, you know, things have kind of peaked and are diminishing. Is that what you're hearing? What do you know basically about the state of play right now?
Sure. So it's Thursday, January 15th, and you're right. It's been a few days after the mass crackdown. and also the communications shut down, and the protests have certainly slowed. We're not hearing, both from eyewitness reporting and also imaging, we're not hearing much of protests continuing right now on the ground. There was sort of two phases to the protests, as you said. Initially, they started in the heart of Tehran Bazaar with merchants as a response to the devaluation of the Iranian currency and a policy change in a certain class of subsidies that the government used to provide to these that would affect these merchants. That's why it started with that specific group in the form of strikes, closing of shops, and then taking to the street. If you look at initial images, they're literally in the streets of the Tehran Bazaar, and then it spread across the city. And then in the second phase, it spread across the country. And what was interesting was that at the initial phase, the government didn't really have this iron fist crackdown approach. In fact, you saw the president coming out, the speaker of the administration, senior members of the government suggesting that they want to negotiate, meet the protesters. They met with some of the leaders of the bazaar protests and promised some economic changes, try to mitigate the impact. And also, essentially, with this cash that was freed up from that subsidy removal from the merchants, they try to inject some of that into the consumer. Tens of millions of Iranians received a little bit of a cash payment into their account. And I think they thought that they could sort of moderate and respond to these protests in a different way than they have in the past mass protests. And also, the protests were not as big when they started. They were in Tehran, limited mostly to the bazaar. But then the second phase came sort of a week later when the protests started spreading like wildfire. There were calls from the outside, from the diaspora, for people to take to the streets and join these protests. It was no longer limited to the bazaar. It was just like a mainstream of various demographics, cities and towns pouring to the street. We saw very large images in certain places. And with that also came the crackdown. With that came the eventual iron fist crackdown that we saw back in 2022, the mass protests, and also in 2019. And towards the end of 2009, these mass protests that were spreading like wildfire and eventually were suppressed. And with that also came a communications shutdown. First, it's aimed at preventing mobilizing and communication on the ground for protesters. It's also meant to limit news sharing and info sharing within the country. So you may end up being in a small town far away from these protests and not even knowing that this is going on if the state television is state media are not covering it and you don't have access to the internet and outside. And also, of course, limiting whatever can come out of the protests as far as images and news to the outside, because international media have very limited presence and ability or freedom to go around the country. And so it just a lot of what's covered from Iran, unfortunately, is from the outside. And so anyways, with that communication shutdown came the iron fist crackdown. And now we're slowly hearing the reports that the death toll has been very high. And I think human rights organizations now are documenting over 3,000 killed. This is the highest death toll of a mass protest crackdown that we know in recent memory of these mass protests in Iran and the Islamic Republic. And it's just been really violent and deadly and severe. And the state also, I think this is another added layer to this, is that the state claims that the number of security forces killed is also pretty high compared to past protests, and that there has been violence. And they claim, quote unquote, terrorists, trained or armed terrorists, were blending into the protests. Now, it's on them to try to provide evidence and prove that, but there seems to be sort of a new format of these protests shaping. And speaking to people who have been on the ground, I've heard myself and from other colleagues that people have compared it to a war zone in certain scenes, like an urban sort of war zone warfare. And really horrific, really violent. And it just has not been like anything that we've seen in the past 2-3 decades of mass protests.
So let's table the foreign element of that, because I know that's something that you know, the Iranians have talked about, the Iranian government has talked about, that's been kind of bandied around, is if there's, you know, to the what extent, if any, there's sort of foreign involvement in these protests. But I want to first kind of talk about the backdrop to all of this, and the reason, maybe part of the reason why things got so big and so heated, so violent this time around, because this has been building for a long time, right? I mean, the grievances, you know, the start of this was the economic grievance, the devaluation of the crash of the Iranian rial in the face of the nuclear sanctions that were reimposed late last year, just the general economic suffering that's been going on for, you know, in Iran for years now. And as you said, the government initially started out in its response sort of acknowledging these grievances and saying, we want to meet with people, we want to organize, you know, we want to figure out how to address their concerns or how to make things easier. But the government's ability to respond to this is very limited at this point, right? I mean, they're very handcuffed by sanctions and by just the general kind of economic conditions. So there's only so far they can go. And then, you know, they don't go far enough to satisfy the protesters, which causes the protests to get bigger. And then the impetus, then, if you can't address things productively, is to crack down, right? Is that sort of the cycle that we're seeing?
Yes, absolutely. So the state of the Iranian economy, which is pretty bad, I, you know, don't know anyone that I'm in touch with underground from middle classes, working classes, who says, oh yeah, life is going great, and you know, the state of the economy is really working for me, except for a minority elite, in different forms and shapes, some within the regime, some adjacent, that have actually benefited from this economy. There's a class of profiteers, sanctions profiteers, Kasaban al-Tahrim, that have in fact become more wealthy and powerful through the sanctions. The majority of the population, the economy has not worked for them. The inflation, rising inflation, prices of commodities, and despite the government trying to provide all kinds of subsidies here and there, it's just not worked. And the reason for the state of the economy is threefold. This is, I look at it sort of as a triangle, and they're all three are connected and very much related. First is this mismanagement of resources inside the country. That's been something ongoing for many years and years. And it's not just the economy. It's, you know, the environmental policies, various different layers of political, economic. And this goes hand in hand also with corruption in various levels. Again, low level, mid level, high level. The different tiers of corruption in the country, and sanctions, as you mentioned, economic sanctions. It's a country that's severely sanctioned, one of the most sanctioned countries in the world. The sanctions have targeted every industry in Iran. This is a country that's rich in natural resources and human capital. It's a fairly young society, well-educated, but the sanctions have really pushed the country into economic financial isolation from most of the world, because they're not just what we call primary sanctions, but also secondary sanctions. Essentially, the United States threatens other countries and other companies, and now with tariffs, countries from doing business with Iran and penalties. And so these go hand in hand. The corruption is very much tied to sanctions. The mismanagement is tied to the corruption. And of course, sanctions is sort of the shadow on top of all of these. Without addressing all three, the economy is not going to sort of improve in a way that's acceptable to many Iranians. No matter how much you crack down on all the corrupt actors, which is something every administration, every president has now promised. You look at Iranian election campaigns, presidential, even local, corruption is a big theme everyone wants to come in and crack down on corruption all the way to the top. The Supreme Leader has talked about it. But first of all, it's these corrupt networks, and not just individuals, but networks have become so powerful, but also without sanctions removal. I mean, until sanctions exist, it's impossible to completely remove this corruption, because a big part of that corruption is very much tied to the sanctions. Essentially, the state has to rely on non-state, unofficial, non-transparent networks, entities, and individuals to do trade on behalf of the state in a way to circumvent sanctions and hide the traces. And that in itself is a breeding ground for corruption. And so, yes, so the state of the economy, here and there you can do band-aid policies or short-term policies. There's also been complex ways of providing subsidies for the government to try to mitigate the harm for different classes. And each of them has proved to have its own glitch down the line. For example, Iranian gas in Iran is very cheap. I believe still the cheapest at the pump in the world. Well, it's an oil-rich country, and it's almost become not just an economic policy, but sort of a social political policy of the population, essentially as an inherent right that if we're an oil-rich country, one of the most richest, why should we be paying an expensive price? And what that initially that made sense. Okay, let's provide cheap subsidized gas to our own population. But what happened is a lot of smuggling started to form in that. This just one example, but cheap gas is bought inside Iran and then smuggled to neighboring countries to be sold at a closer to a world market price. That's just one example. So, It's just gotten worse and worse. Inflation is high. Add to this also the post-COVID era and, you know, this just sort of global landscape that we're seeing rising of prices. And then on top of all of that is geopolitics, military actions in the region, threats, an actual war that happened in June. All of those also impact the market. When you get only threats of military strikes from the U.S., that usually impacts the Iranian market or the value of the currency, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very complex. It's not an easy problem. It's not just that they don't have the will, but it's also multi-layered, and these layers are all connected. And without a comprehensive shift in domestic and foreign and regional policy, you can't tackle this issue fully.
So that leads me into my next question. Every time a protest movement breaks out in Iran, even ones that have been smaller than this one, the commentary in the West is always, you know, is this it for the Islamic Republic? Is it on its last legs? You know, is it going to fall? Is this the thing that's going to finally push it over? And
it's not always a question. It's a statement. This is it.
Yeah.
This is it.
Like, this is the end. Right. You get, you know, sort of the journalists ask the question, and then you get, you know, pundits falling from the sky to say, yes, this is the end. It's over. And, you know, that has yet to come to pass. There was no point during this protest, which again seems to be, as we said, kind of tapering off, where it really felt like the Iranian government was at risk of collapsing. And yet, this was definitely an escalation. The more this goes on, I mean, you can go back to the Mahsa Amini protests, and there's some similarities there. There have been smaller economic protests, but this feels like the tension is just going to continue to build, and it's going to get, you know, the economic grievance can't be addressed or won't be addressed. There's you know, structural reasons at this point why it can't be. And so I guess my question is, you know, could we be a few cycles away from something that really does threaten the stability of the Iranian government?
Well, thank you for bringing that up. And it's very accurate. I don't want to fall into also predicting that it won't happen, because, you know, sure, there needs to be accountability on that side too. But you're absolutely right. It's been years, if not decades, that you have pundits at every mass protest saying this is it. And, I guess never been asked afterwards what happened. during Masa Amini also.
Nobody ever asks. Yeah, nobody. As long as you have the right opinion, nobody asks you afterwards why you were wrong. Yeah.
For the moment, yes. I mean, during Masa Amini, it was being called a revolution. And in all fairness, I think back then I was calling it a cultural revolution. Looking back, I still think it was very revolutionary. But not in the sense of a political revolution, of a collapse or a change of a regime, but the cultural, social and cultural change that really was revolutionary. I mean, if you look at the Iranian society, how women dress, the, really rolling back of the mandatory hijab post-2022 and before 2022 is incomparable. So it did have an impact. That's actually a good example of a protest movement that at a very high price also people lost their lives, people lost, were injured, maimed, and many were arrested. But it did succeed in pushing the state back after years and decades of resistance by women, which culminated in that moment, pushing the state back to where they are now, that mandatory hijab has almost become the enforcement has almost stopped by the state, and they realize that this can really turn into a national security issue and an existential issue, and they've given up for now. And I think the genie's out of the bottle for that. You can't put it back in. The Iranian society is not going to go back to pre-2022. So I think the protests, but my point is that they do sort of put this pressure on the system, at least a sense of urgency that things need to change. And we see that in the statements of the officials and the acknowledgement, you know, to the highest level. No one claims that the economy is doing great or that there's no corruption or that management of the resources, all of that. Yes, there's more a blame put on sanctions, on the U.S., on the West, but there is a widespread acknowledgement, and like I said, in every election campaign, of this mismanagement, of the corruption, and how they're going to come in with new policies to crack down. But it's just been difficult, and that's why the protests, I think, feel different. Well, every time, but especially this last time, because they're just angrier than before. Every time this mass protests happen, people come to the street with grievances that are very legitimate, political, economic, social, whatever. And then there's a crackdown, they go back home. If the grievances are not addressed, they just pile up another layer, and the next time they come out even angrier. So I would say the first explanation when people ask me how is it different, I'm just that people are much more angrier than the last time they came to this street. And so there's that, and I think there's also a foreign, I don't want to talk about foreign intervention, but at least a foreign narrative, a rhetoric that would sort of manufacture this feeling that this is something that it wasn't, or that this is somehow going to get combined with a military action from the outside, which hasn't happened. Doesn't look like it's happening yet. And I think that gave a sense of false hope to many on the ground of something that wasn't even clear what it is. Like when the president of the United States says help is on the way, what does that mean? First of all, who is? Right. I mean, suddenly from saying the U.S. is locked and loaded, the rhetoric changed to the Iranians called me for meetings, I'm going to meet with them. And then it changed to within a few days, it changed to a third person sort of vague help is on the way. From where? From who? What kind of help? And also we can maybe talk about this later in more detail, but how this sort of foreign military intervention or threat would actually help, I think it hurts the movement on the ground. But I hope this answered your question, but maybe we can talk about that foreign threat.
Yeah, I think more. I mean, what I was trying to articulate is exactly what you said, that it just, people get angrier and angrier the longer that, you know, this goes on, that grievances are not addressed. And it just feels like that's a cycle that's going to continue. But you're leading into it, but I do want to talk about kind of the U.S., I don't even know if you can call it a response, just like the all over the map running commentary that Donald Trump has had about this for the last week and a half or so. I first of all, the question of military intervention, and when he says help is coming, and you know, as you say, there's some hope that there's going to be outside help for these protesters. I don't know what that would look like. The U.S. doesn't want to put any forces in Iran, certainly. So the idea is to bomb something. I don't know what you could bomb, I guess, that would actually give the protests a boost, or you know, anything more than a symbolic boost. And if you actually go into the cities and start, you know, attacking, like striking Iranian security forces who are intermingled with the protesters, protesters are going to die. Ordinary people are going to die. Citizens who are not protesting are going to die. And it feels like you would only be discrediting the protests then in the eyes of the majority of Iranians. So I guess I'm not asking you to explain the rationale, because the U.S. turns to airstrikes anytime anything happens. But like, do you see a way that that would even be possible for the U.S. to involve itself militarily that could actually help the protesters?
So I think if I want to divide that into two parts, is it possible for the U.S. to involve itself? Yes. The U.S. has a very powerful toolbox with many tools, all of which are military hard power, and it can pick any of those tools, you know, you name it. Would it help the protesters on the ground? I don't think so. I mean, depends on what option. I am yet to hear one option as far as this military toolbox that is going to help the protesters on the ground. We saw in June, the so-called 12-day war, when the Israelis attacked Iran and then the U.S. joined. The Israelis were saying, and they still do, that that was a war in the Iranian regime. They have no problem with the Iranian people, and that they targeted in a very precise way Iranian regime officials, regime strongholds and centers, and the nuclear program. And what happened was over 1,000 Iranians were killed in just a matter of less than 2 weeks, most of them civilians. Nuclear scientists who were targeted, assassinated in their homes with their families. There are instances of apartment buildings of about 12 units around, two floors below, two floors up. There is no precision, you know, targeted strike that we have seen that has succeeded. And then the U.S. joined in bombing Iran's nuclear program. So that's an option that's now already taken. Beyond that, I don't know. I mean, the president has said no, he doesn't want to commit boots on the ground. So we're not looking at an Iraq or Afghanistan measure, because yes, the U.S. can do regime change. They just did in Venezuela, anywhere in the world, pretty much. Doesn't mean the next regime is going to be better, or life is going to get better for the people in that country. There will be better governance, or that terrorism is not going to spill over into all the countries around them. I mean, you know, these are the consequences. And especially when it comes to the Middle East, the track record of U.S. intervention and military intervention has been all failures. In Iran, even, U.S. intervention, we go all the way back to 1953, the successful coup, CIA, MI6, U.S. and U.K., and we saw how that turned out. So the track record...
They all lived happily ever after.
Exactly. They all, I mean, so my question is, show me the precedents. Show me one good example, because there are Iranians inside the country, outside the country, who say, you know, I'm at my wit's end. It can't get any worse than this. Let them come and finish the job. And I ask them, like, what exactly is the ideal model that you're looking at? Show me. Is it Iraq? Is it Afghanistan? Is it Syria? Is it Libya? If there's no boots on the ground, how is it going to look like? Is it going to be sustained air campaigns? If it wants to be effective as far as really hurting or collapsing the regime, it's going to look like Libya. If it's Syria, which was a country with a very strong armed rebel movement, more than one, with a lot of foreign intervention by almost every neighbor, funds, arms, training, including the U.S., What we see today in Syria came out of 10 years of civil war. So is that the path? Another Syria, a much bigger, much more populated country in the region, turning into the next Syria. So what are the models? Or is it just sort of a surreal, you know, euphoria of something that hasn't happened before and we just assume can happen, but in reality, it's going to look like one of these examples that I'm talking about. So yeah, I don't even know if the president exactly had this and like thought about this so deeply when he said locked and loaded. The U.S. is always locked and loaded. They can take out the entire world. But how is that going to help protesters? if one of the options, kinetic options that's been discussed, is bombing regime strongholds, IRGC, besiege forces, how is that going to help protesters? I mean, these are going to be in civilian areas. These forces are going to flock to where the protesters are. Are you going to take out all of them together? Are the protesters going to be hurt both by the security forces on the ground and also by bombs coming from the sky? So I don't know. I can't think of any military option that would actually be helpful unless it's symbolic. You know, it's symbolic. Doesn't really change the calculation on the ground. But as far as non-kinetic options, then that makes it even more diverse. You know, there's cyber attacks, sabotages, you name it. We've seen examples. Again, I don't know how that would exactly strengthen the hand of the protesters, because we're talking about a domestic unrest, an internal issue, changing of these policies, and a geopolitical layer that I think is really added on without the well-being of the protesters in mind. I don't think the freedom to protest, freedom of speech is really the matter for this administration. Look at how they're treating protesters in the United States. So yeah, I think this was a geopolitical issue, and they saw an opening with the protests, and that they just conflated the two.
I will say the answer anytime you ask is Donald Trump thought deeply about this, whatever this is, the answer is no. So we can assume that he had not. But let's talk for a second about some of the outside Iranian actors, not to get into, you know, whether Mossad was, or what, to what degree, you know, Israeli intelligence is on the ground here facilitating anything, or the U.S., you know, is inside Iran facilitating anything. But to talk about the two main players, to be honest, which are Reza Pahlavi, the son of the former Shah of Iran, and MEK, who are the two big kind of exile factions here, kind of playing out their fantasies of overthrowing the Islamic Republic and coming in and taking charge. What did you make of, to start with Reza Pahlavi, of his involvement here? There was a moment where he made a public call for demonstrations, and that was right around the time the blackout went into effect. But there did seem to be, you know, there were reports of major demonstrations. Whether you can connect those two things or not, I don't know, but they certainly seem to be correlated somehow. And it was at that point that I sort of thought, you know, if there's a demonstration here that Reza Pahlavi has some purchase in Iran and can actually organize protests on the ground, that could change the nature of these protests into something that the Iranian government really sees as a threat. But I don't think that went anywhere. And I'm just sort of curious, as you were observing, you've been observing his involvement over the last couple of weeks, what you make of it.
So look, I mean, the different mechanisms for a change in leadership like that, you know, they're running leadership and the system is not going to voluntarily give up and go and let the regime transition to whoever the next person is. It's either going to be an internal revolution, something that happened in 1979, there was a leader in exile, the revolution happened and he was able to come back and become the leader of the country, or it has to be done or pushed from the outside, which is sort of an Iraq model. U.S., of course, a mighty military, boots on the ground. It's, you know, the closest, most recent we can think of. U.S. boots on the ground, regime change. And then back then, Ahmad Chalabi was sort of seen as the alternative for the day after in Iraq. And I think the Reza Pahlavi camp, and we also know from reporting by Haaretz in Israel, in the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, that the Israeli government or state-adjacent networks have really invested in sort of creating a social media infrastructure of support for Reza Pahlavi to essentially exaggerate it, I think. Or push him, really present him as an alternative leader for that day after, exactly for that model, for a U.S. model of regime change. And when Americans ask, okay, what about the day after? Who's the alternative? Then he would be presented as the alternative. But then, yes, you're right. His name has been called on street protests inside Iran. Especially after he essentially put out a call in the second week of the protest. So the protests were already happening. This has never happened before. We haven't seen him be able really to bring a crowd organically in the form of protests to the streets. But this was the first time he put out a call as protests were ongoing, and the protests essentially spread and more people came to the street and chanted his name. Of course, it's also, you know, a name that's known in Iran. His father, his grandfather ruled the country, so there is no Iranian who's never heard of that name. That's also the name recognition is as part of what's happening on the ground. And also essentially people being done with the system, or at least the part of people who are on the ground. I think there were estimates of a couple million to 3 million at the height of the protests across the country. Of protesters, of just being done with the system and thinking that, okay, this seems to be the only available alternative. This is who I see on all television channels in the diaspora, on the social media, part of it organic, part of it sort of pushed and hyped with these networks. But this is the alternative. So if I say death to this or an end to this, then I'll switch to this alternative. So in that sense, I would say it's something that we've seen. Now, again, I don't see a movement that has that kind of strength yet on the ground that would be able to do this transition on its own in the form of a revolution, as some call it. And from the outside, also, I don't see how, without committing boots on the ground, like an Iraq model, which the U.S. president and the American public, we know from polling that the majority in this country are done with those kind of regime change, endless wars in the Middle East, $1 trillion U.S. blood and money invested and not really seen as success stories. So I just don't know how that this is going to translate into, from the chants and the slogans and the online presence and the TV interviews, into something that really materializes on the ground yet. I mean, things can change, things can develop or shift fast on the ground. But so far, the state, the Islamic Republic, the state has a monopoly on power, on arms, on violence, and they've been willing and capable of using an iron fist to suppress these protests. Yes, they're dealing with a very serious legitimacy crisis. They know that a majority are unhappy with the status quo to the point that they're willing to come on the street and chant death to. But that hasn't really translated into an existential crisis, sort of that tipping point, only by the movement inside internally.
So maybe as a final question, I want to pull the lens back a little bit and talk about regionally what you've seen here. You know, we know the story at this point, who knows what will happen in the next, you know, day. But after making threats of some kind of an attack, after things seemed, the possibility of a U.S. attack seemed imminent enough that the Iranian government actually closed the country's airspace for several hours, it's now reopened and Donald Trump's threats have subsided. He's now, you know, he was talking about executions as a red line. He's backed off of that, or he hasn't backed off of that. He says the Iranians have assured him somehow that there won't be any executions of protesters and that the killing is stopped. That's his words. So things seem to be kind of, you know, trending away from the possibility of at least an immediate U.S. attack on Iran. Again, who knows what will happen in the next day or two. But one of the reasons that has been reported as to why Trump has sort of stood down a bit has been that he's getting urges from governments in the region, from Saudi Arabia, from Turkey, from other friendly kind of states in the region, not to take any military action. This is, an astonishing change. I mean, if you think about where regional geopolitics were just a few years ago, this is a fairly astonishing flip. But what do you make of that, you know, in terms of, you know, having countries in the Gulf and, you know, elsewhere in the region kind of at this point deciding they would rather just leave things be in Iran and maintain the status quo than risk something that would destabilize, that could destabilize the country?
Absolutely. I mean, there's reporting. We're also in touch with some of these governments and states, diplomats, officials, and it's a real worry. I mean, this, we have to remember, this is one of the largest countries in the region. We're talking about Iran, 90 million people. This, I believe, the second most populated in the Middle East. This is a sort of chaotic situation in Iran is going to look much more, much worse than, for example, Iraq or Afghanistan. And the push or the lobbying or the advocacy by these states, I think, comes from real concern. So Arab countries across the Persian Gulf want stability in the region. They care about their trade, their plans, long-term vision. Saudi Arabia, you name, we saw Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Oman had been trying to put pressure on the White House to reconsider. The Iraqis just across the border are worried when Iran and Israel and the U.S. Engaged. It was essentially going over Iraq, the Iraqis' head. The Turks are concerned. Look at Syria, 10 years of civil war in Syria. Where do the war refugees end up? And you're talking about a much more populated country. So if that kind of chaos is unleashed in Iran, it's not going to be bound to the borders of Iran. Just in June, in the 12-day war in June, which sounded like a, looked like a blip, a lot of Iranians left for Turkey, at least temporarily, when they said evacuate Tehran. Some went into other cities and towns across the country, but some left the country actually through borders to Armenia, through Turkey. So the neighbors are worried, and for good reasons. And the Iranians have also really upped the ante, both public and private, of their threats. So when they felt threatened since June, they have essentially changed this posturing that if we get attacked, we're going to attack back as they did in June. They hit Israel back, that they're going to do it even more. And this time there will be no element of surprise as there was in June. It took them a few days to sort of regroup and start hitting back. And this time, I think they're serious about it. And just that last week, Iranian officials have been saying publicly and also through back channels, threatening really that U.S. bases across the region, many of which are in these Arab countries across the Persian Gulf, these are all going to be legitimate targets if they're hit, that Israel will be hit. Even if the U.S. attacks Iran, they're going to hit Israel and U.S. Bases. We saw Iraqi militias, Shia militias that are close to Iran, issue statements saying, implying threats against American bases and targets. And I think this has been taken very seriously. And in June, after the U.S. joined the war in the attack, post that war in June, the Israeli attacks and then the U.S. attacks, Iran retaliated against the U.S. in Qatar. And that was a significant decision because Qatar is seen as one of Iran's closest friends in the region, but also happens to have to be the country with the largest U.S. base. And so I think the message was that, you know, if things get out of hand, we're not even going to give a pass to our friends. And so they hit that U.S. base with prior coordination in a very limited way to sort of take an off ramp. But I think the message this time to these Arab to all of their neighbors is that it's not going to be contained or predictable as it was before if it comes to an existential crisis. And so, yes, Iran is the underdog in the region vis-a-vis the U.S. and Israel, but they're not completely powerless. And they're a mid-power. They're a regional power. They're also a mid-power. And they have their own toolbox. You know, it may be smaller with more limited tools, but we saw, for example, their missiles during the June war were able to really cause harm in Israel and inflict pain and change the calculation in the course of the war. So yeah, I mean, these are also the ways that the neighbors are looking at this issue and really taking it seriously and then bringing back that back to Washington. And I think the administration, the president, do look at all of these various different factors at the same time. Of course, there's Israel. The Israeli prime minister has been pushing for a U.S. attack and U.S. war on Iran for the past two and so decade, both publicly and privately. But he's not, they're not the only actor in the region that Donald Trump listens to. And then finally, if I can add something domestic to this, there's also inside the U.S. and within his own party a divide. They're sort of the more classic neocon wing of the Republican Party, some of whom have occupied senior positions in the administration. But then there's also the more restrained or MAGA wing of the party who have influence of the Republican Party, who have influence both inside the administration and also outside, you know, people with very strong voices like Tucker Carlson or Steve Bannon. And we see that they've been really activated in public and vocal against a potential military engagement with Iran.
So, Nigar, on that note, I think we'll leave it there for now. As I say, anything can happen here. Trump's behavior over the last few days has made it clear that he could decide to do anything at any given time. But I do thank you for coming on the program again. It was on short notice. I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. And we look forward to having you back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And it was great to be back.
Desk. 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 Desk.